I want to thank you for being with us, a Democrat representing Maryland's 8th Congressional District in the House of Representatives, author of the book Unthinkable. This is Democracy Now! Back in 20 seconds.
Khele sagal jagata
Avanguru by Brooklyn-based musician Sunny Singh. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Acclaimed author Arundhati Roy could soon face trial under India's contested anti-terror laws after an official from Prime Minister Narendra Modi's far-right BJP party gave the go-ahead for her prosecution. The charges against Roy stem from comments she made about Kashmir in 2010. Free speech advocates have expressed outrage over the persecution of Arundhati Roy, as well as other critics of Modi, who was sworn in last week to his third term as prime minister, albeit with BJP having lost its parliamentary majority in a stunning defeat. For more, we're joined by the award-winning Indian author and journalist Siddharth Deb. Welcome back to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes. It may shock a lot of people who have followed Arundhati over the years, the remarkable award-winning author. Explain what she faces.
Well, she's been, this case is so convoluted, it's hard to say where it begins, where it ends, and that's the point. The process is the punishment. It's for a seminar that she took part in 2010. A right-wing sort of person lodged charges with the police. Most of them, some of them have expired. But this the lieutenant governor of Delhi, who is very much a Modi man, has announced in the media that they're going to allow the police to pursue and to, you know, to file a charge sheet against her, and that they're going to do it under this notorious anti-terror law called UAPA, the Unlawful Activities Prevention Act. And that act, that there are many people in prison already under that. It's the process that is a torture. People have died in prison while waiting for trial, including Father Stan Swamy, the noted sort of Jesuit activist and priest. So that's what they are basically threatening Roy with. My understanding is that her lawyers haven't received anything official from the government yet. So this is all being played out in the media, and that is the whole point of it.
Why now? I mean, we're talking about something she said in 2010. This is 14 years later.
Yes. That's because the BJP is stunned by the electoral reverse. They have lost face. They have been in disarray. There's a lot of infighting going on. And they significantly lost Ayodhya, where the Ram temple was built. They have run out of ideas. This is Narendra Modi's attempt to show that everything is normal. And, you know, charging Roy is basically throwing his rabid attack dogs of Hindu nationalism. It's throwing them a bone so that they can get excited about it. It's an attempt to show that they are in control. They're in charge. Nothing has changed.
Well, of course, we'll continue to follow this. Will Arundhati Roy be prosecuted in India? Siddharth Deb is the award-winning Indian author and journalist. His new nonfiction book is called Twilight Prisoners: The Rise of the Hindu Right and the Fall of India. His most recent novel, The Light at the End of the World. That does it for our show. We have a remarkable group of people who produce this program, and we thank them all very much. See our podcast at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we devote the entire show's focus to the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base Detention Center in Cuba. We start by talking with a filmmaker who just released a feature film on the subject.
Our guest is Felipe Diaz, the director and producer of I Am Gitmo, which puts a human face on the grotesque detention center at Guantanamo. We're then joined by Reverend Ron Steef, the executive director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture.
The National Religious Campaign Against Torture, or NRCAT, is one of more than 300 organizations calling for the immediate, complete shutdown of this offshore, unaccountable, barbaric detention center. Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer. It's been 22 years since the U.S. opened its prison at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. Specifically, it was 4 months after the September 11th, 2001 attacks on the World Trade Center. We saw images of men and boys arriving there, bound and hooded, in orange jumpsuits, confined indefinitely, without charges, legal process, or trials. And it was not long after that we began hearing reports that the U.S. government was using torture, and even that prisoners were dying there. Again, without even being charged with any crime, let alone tried by any court. The U.S. justified its tactics as necessary to win the, quote, war on terror, end quote. But U.N. experts and human rights activists globally have called for the U.S. to close the facility due to its, quote, unrelenting human rights violations, end quote. In 2009, President Obama took steps to close Guantanamo, but in 2018, Trump signed an executive order to keep it open. President Biden was then elected, signaling he'd close it, but the subject has been largely ignored ever since. Today, 30 prisoners remain. Our guest is Felipe Diaz, a filmmaker who is shining a spotlight on the humanity of the men and boys who have lived, and some who have died, in Guantanamo Bay Prison. His latest film, the award-winning I Am Gitmo, is a story about a Muslim schoolteacher in Afghanistan who was accused of being a terrorist and then imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay Prison without charges or hope of being released. Felipe Diaz is not only the writer and director of I Am Gitmo, but he is also the founder of Cinema Libre Studio, a boutique film company created in 2003 with a consortium of partners to provide an alternative structure for intelligent, independent films to get developed, financed, produced, and distributed. Felipe Diaz, a warm welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. You know, I have a great admiration for the work you do. So glad to be here.
Oh, thank you. Well, I know filmmaking is such an investment of time, energy, and of course, money. What inspired you and your team to undertake the project of making a feature film about Guantanamo Bay?
Well, you know, so it's a long answer, but I'll make it short for you. The issue is, you know, I created 33 years ago this production distribution company that I still run here in Los Angeles, and we are specialized in doing social political films. Feature film documentaries. We distributed probably 300 of this film, this type of film since the beginning. And the reason is that we believe and we know for a fact that movie can make a difference in the world. You know, since we have been doing that, we have been tackling every single, you know, you can imagine social issue with our films. You pick a subject and I'm sure we distributed a movie about it. So, and we saw during all these years that, in fact, you know, it makes a difference because we have, throughout the years, we received countless email letters, phone calls of people saying, oh my God, this movie changed my life. Thank you so much for doing it. Now I'm doing this and this and that. And it even changed laws. You know, we were able to screen movie in Congress, bring some changes like that. So long story short is that we are always interested by subject which will make a difference. And when I started to read, that was probably in 2002 or 3, I believe, that there was not only people brought to Guantanamo, but there was, you know, a word getting out from soldiers or lawyers or whatever that they were being tortured. I started to feel, well, my first reaction was, no, that's not possible. The U.S. doesn't torture people. You know, it's in every single law, in every single international agreement, in every single manual that the military uses or even the CIA uses. You do not torture people. But, of course, I knew also in the back of my mind that there was people who had been denouncing torture, like, for example, John Kiriakou and, you know, and other people. So I started to feel, well, you know, maybe I should look at that. And the big shock, so I started to look at all the transcripts of trial, which were started to come out, and lawyers, you know, starting to testify and so on and so forth. And the big shock, I have to say, was when I read the first book on the subject, which was Mohamedou Houlslahi's book called Guantanamo Diary. Guantanamo Diary was a fascinating piece on the bad side, of course, because it was fascinating because this man spent 13 years in Guantanamo, and he has been tortured on a regular basis because for some reason, which is still not clear, but I have a little explanation coming from John Kiriakou, actually. The reason for which he was suspected of being part of it is because he spoke fluent English. And that was always a trigger for the interrogators and the soldiers. Anybody who would speak English was suspect because it means they were taught to do something internationally and so on and so forth. True or not, doesn't matter. So Mohamedou wrote a diary, as his book says, you know, a diary of every day what happened to him in Guantanamo. You know, starting from, you know, the interrogation where he was badly treated to all form of torture he was subject to. And that, I have to say, I could not even drop the book. I think I spent a day and a night, you know, reading it, and I said, that is impossible. So I even tried to buy the rights of the book to make a movie about it, because that's the way that's my weapon of choice, you know, the camera. And the rights had been sold already to another company who will make this big movie, you know, with Jodie Foster and Shailene Woodley and all that, called The Mauritanian. When I heard that, I said, okay, well, it's clear, great, they are doing it, that's wonderful. But later on, I was able to get a copy of the screenplay. It made me so angry. That's the reason I decided to do I Am Gitmo, because the book of Mohamedou, it's all about him, you know, as the subject of torture, and it's pretty much entirely about torture and what happened to him. In the screenplay that they were ready to do, it was not anymore about Mohamedou's ordeal. It was about the great lawyer, who is Nancy Olander, and she's a great lawyer, no question about that, who would fight with her assistant, Shailene Woodley, to get him out. So it was, again, another white hero movie where this wonderful lawyer, you know, is saving the day. And I was like, wait a minute, where is the torture? And, oh, yes, there was in the screenplay, and there is in the movie, a little montage of 2 minutes of torture. And I was like, what? And so, of course, so within the torture was almost dropped out entirely of the movie, pretty much. And even worse than that, Guantanamo seems to be an okay place at the end of the day in the movie. He plays, you know, a soccer in the courtyard with another inmate. But the interrogators are pretty cool. You know, they crack jokes with him and this and that. And for me, the worst part as a filmmaker is that at the end of the day, you have a little bit of a montage of the real Mohamedou, who became famous and rich, I have to say, in a way, because he published his book, which became a bestseller, etc. At the end of the day, most of the people who saw it, you know, thought, oh, well, that was not so bad, right? Guantanamo was not so bad. Yeah, it was roughed up a little bit for a little time, you know, and this and that, and became rich and famous. So what's wrong with that? And that, of course, I can tell you when I read the screenplay, I was angry about what I was reading, that I said, okay, that's enough with these white hero movies. We need to make one movie from the point of view of the guy who is being tortured, with this Middle Eastern man captured in his country and thrown in this hell. And it's why I even put, you know, I even tried to put the camera in the shoes of this guy, you know, when he's under the hood, you know, the camera is under the hood. When he's in a box for mock execution, the camera is in the box, et cetera, et cetera. I wanted people to feel, I wanted people to think watching the film, what would I feel if one day it was happening to me? What if one day someone come knocks at my door and say, oh, come with us. And they asked me this stupid question, like it was happening to all these men, where is Bin Laden? And of course, most of these men didn't know, because I can explain that to you later if you want, to your audience, is that these men were sold to the CIA for money. So of course, most of them were innocent. But, you know, so they were asking this stupid question, and when most of them didn't even know who Bin Laden was, they would say, oh, you don't want to answer? Okay, torture. Sorry, it's a long answer, but that's what pushed me to do I Am Gitmo, because I said that is totally unacceptable in any way, shape, and form. So here is my long answer to your question.
Philippe, it's a good answer. I had the pleasure of seeing the trailer of the film. So I gather it's based on true events, but tell us the plot so the audience gets a sense of the narrative arc of the film. And how does the storyline compare with actual detainees and their conditions at Guantanamo?
Absolutely. You know, it's a good question, because that's the core of the matter, is that what I wanted to do, I wanted to make an exact movie of what happened to these men, which means, to be clear, I didn't pile up on my hero, you know, what happened to different guys. No, they were all the, let's say, the high-level target, as they call them, you know, were all submitted to the same treatment. So what's happening to these guys is exactly what happened to all these men. After 9/11, the Bush administration, Cheney and Rumsfeld were the leaders of that. The Bush administration decided that they had to find the terrorist, you know, responsible for 9/11. Donald Rumsfeld had this brilliant idea, and I'm being sarcastic here, the idea of printing millions of leaflets that he would drop all over Afghanistan saying, bring me a terrorist, we'll give you a lot of money. And at the time, it was really a lot of money in Afghanistan. They were giving anywhere from, I think, $2,000 to $20,000. This kind of money changed your life in Afghanistan. It's a gigantic amount of money in terms of the condition of living there. So, of course, which means that pretty much tons of people started to turn anybody, the neighbor they didn't like, the taxi driver because they wanted his car, the neighbor with the piece of land they were, they wanted to add to their own piece of land, et cetera, et cetera. And so you had all these people being brought in for interrogation, and it's exactly as it happened in the movie. They were put immediately through question and then torture. So to answer your question about the plot, I didn't want to make a whole good guy, you know, thrown in hell. So the guy is a former, which happened to a lot of these men, is a former fighter in the war against the USSR at the time. In the 80s, there was this war of liberation in Afghanistan, liberation between quotes, where the USSR was defending the government of the time, who was communist. The US raised this army and enlisted, you know, all the traditional Muslim people, because they hated the Russian at the time, you know, to be part of it. They enlisted Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, it's always important to remind that Al-Qaeda was the partner of the U.S., and the U.S. financed Bin Laden and Al-Qaeda at the time, and to fight these people. So my guy is a former fighter, and that's what happened to a lot of them. All the fighters who were on the side of the U.S., you know, at the time, but therefore also on the side of Al-Qaeda, now are becoming suspect because Al-Qaeda turned against the U.S., okay? it's insane, but it's always good to remember that. So my guy is a guy, he has been, so he's living in Afghanistan, he's married, he has children, he's a teacher in a school, you know, and one day someone knock at his door and say, which is the police, the local police, come with us, we have questions to ask you. He's brought in front of an American interrogator, asked him the question. He said, "What Bin Laden? Never met Bin Laden. Don't know. I know who he is, but I never met him, never talked to him, whatever." Okay. And he's being sent to Bagram Air Base, which was one of the black sites, what we call black site, is the secret site of the CIA, run by the CIA. And that he's interrogated, he's punched and kicked and started to be tortured, waterboarded, etc., to make him talk because they are convinced, they are not convinced, but they think that everybody has information about Bin Laden and they want to make him talk. And when clearly he doesn't have the information or, according to them, doesn't want to answer, he's sent to Guantanamo. And that's the beginning of hell. So that's the plot of the movie.
Well, if you're just tuning in, this is Law and Disorder. I'm Maria Hall, and my co-host Steve Rohde and I are interviewing filmmaker Felipe Diaz about his latest film, I Am Gitmo. Well, Felipe Diaz, since there's so much secrecy surrounding Guantanamo Bay Prison, how did you go about researching for the film? Did the U.S. government cooperate with you, or did you have to rely on other sources?
I said at the beginning that we have all these wonderful letters and email of people saying you do a wonderful job, but we receive also throughout the years death threat and threat of lawsuits and whatever. So we know it works, so we decided to keep it totally secret that we are doing this movie. So, of course, I could not go to the U.S. government for information. But during all these the following years that I was describing at the beginning, we started to have a lot of lawyers volunteering their time and their money, you know, because not only they had to volunteer their time not being paid, but also pay for their own trip to Guantanamo and pay for their own expenses, et cetera, et cetera. But they volunteered to defend these men. And so there were a lot of lawyers. One of the schemes of the government was to say, well, all these men have no right to be legally defended. They have even no right to contest their imprisonment because they are not, you know, fighters taken during a war. They created this new concept called enemy combatant. And as enemy combatant, they have no right. They are not protected by anything. So they don't have a right to trial. They don't have any kind of legal rights, which is, of course, a joke because, you know, there's no such thing in the Geneva Convention who gives you the right to create a new concept which takes people away from protection in the Geneva Convention. But that's what they did. So the lawyers volunteered, a lot of lawyers volunteered to challenge that and to say that is not possible. You cannot imprison someone without giving him the right to defend himself. And so we started to get a lot of transcripts, a lot of people were doing interviews. Some few prisoners were being released and were, of course, talking about their situation. Mohamedou Houlslahi, you know, was able to get Guantanamo Diary, all his manuscripts, you know, taken out of Guantanamo by his lawyer. So we started to have all this documentation, and the more, and it's why Guantanamo is still not closed, is what I believe, because every time that they will release one man, the man will do press conference, he will write books, he will do interviews and denounce torture, of course, which they should. You know, so that's one of the reasons it's not closed. But the main issue is that, if you want, at the time, they had no legal rights. We got all these transcripts from trial, and I have probably like 5 feet tall of transcript from these trials, and every single one of them, every single book, every single interview, and you know, there was also a book written because, let's be clear, it's not that all the military was bad and all the, you know, it's not that. There was even soldiers who wrote books saying that is unacceptable. Even CIA people, well, of course, the case of John Kiriakou, you know, is a good one. You know, I'll make a little parenthesis because John came in New York to support us when we released the film there, and he told me how it all started. He was, you know, he was the head of the Pakistan branch of the CIA, so he was very high on the scale. And the first man which were brought to his office, the first, you know, suspect of this terrorist supposedly branch who were brought to his office, were shackled and hooded. And he said, no, that's not acceptable. By in our rules, you cannot hood a suspect, you know, like that, take the hoods off. And his number two in command said, John, you cannot do that. It came from the White House. If you take the hoods off, I'm going to report you to the main office. And John looked at him, of course, shocked, and says, that's the law. So we're going to take the hoods off, and if you prevent me from doing that, I will report you to the main office. And they both reported each other to the main office. And of course, as we know the story, John lost and, you know, ended up spending years in jail because of this, because of course he went out and denounced the use of torture against these men. So if you want, we got a lot of material at the time. So that's what I used to base the story, because when you read all the transcripts, all the books, all the interviews, pretty much it's exactly always the same thing, because at the end, this new torture methods, or let's say enhanced interrogation technique, as it was nicely called, you know, were applied on a systemic way. Like it was not a few bad apples doing a few bad things to a few detainees. That was never like that. It was coming from the White House. It was coming down the chain of command, and it was organized by one of the characters that I put in the film, and that's his real name, and it's a real character, is General Miller. Miller was in charge of Guantanamo at the time and organized with Donald Rumsfeld, you know, and all the other people around to create this new kind of methods. And as I make him say in the movie, and that's an exact line, yes, it can lead to dislocation of limbs, or they can even lose their lives. But that's the way we have to deal, because everybody at the time was brainwashed by the fact that all these people were the worst, I quote, the worst of the worst terrorists. So, of course, if you are an officer, a military, a soldier, whatever it is, or an interrogator, thinking that you are dealing with the worst of the worst terrorists, and I quote again, who are planning 10 more 9/11, then, of course, you will have a different attitude that if you say, well, we don't know if this guy is guilty or not, just try to figure it out. That's what I used to do the movie. You know, it was very easy to put together all these pieces and see exactly what all these men are going through.
Philippe, as a filmmaker, what do you want audiences to experience during the film? And what impressions do you want to have them take away after watching I Am Gitmo?
Well, I can tell you that my goal, you know, was always to make the audience feel or think, what would I feel if it was happening to me? And I had even, you know, so for me, you know, and it's why I did it also, I would have no way to do it as a documentary, because I will never have the material to do it. Of course, they would never let me shoot in Guantanamo. But I also wanted it to do it as a feature film, because I wanted to bring it to the emotional level. And I was very comforted in that, you know, we had the support for the release of the film from this wonderful lady called Fionnuala Niaolin, who is the former UN human rights reporter, was the only person authorized to visit Guantanamo. And she told me it took her 6 years to fight the government to enforce them to agree to let her go to Guantanamo. So finally they relented and let her go. And she wrote this damning report, you know, which is whatever, 15 pages long, you know, explaining the abuse of detainees and the use of torture, et cetera, et cetera. And I was very surprised when I started to get in touch with her, and she loved the film, she think it's brilliant, blah, blah, blah. And she flew from the East Coast to Los Angeles for the premiere to be there with us and defend the film, et cetera. And I said at the moment, I said, Fionnuala, I'm grateful that you do that. Of course, it's wonderful. But why would you spend so much of your time and energy to defend our film? And she said, she had a wonderful answer. She said, it's very simple. She said, it's because in the last 6 years, fighting all these legal battles as UN reporter of human rights, UN special reporter of human rights and counterterrorism, because that was her specialty, you know, she said, it showed me the limit of the legal fight. She battled many governments. She fought against many governments. The last one was against the Syrian government for the abuse of detainees there. So she went to all these very difficult places. And she said, these 6 years showed me the limit of the legal fight. We won many battles against many governments. Did it change anything? No, it did not. You know, pretty much we won the battle against the government. Does the government change their policy? Or zero? She says, so now the only way that we can make things change is to bring it to an emotional level and convince the people that something is wrong and we have to fix it. I was very, very grateful to hear that, of course, because I was grateful for her support, but I was also very grateful to hear that because it's exactly what we have been trying, what I've been doing all my life. You know, I produced 25 movies and directed some and, you know, et cetera. And that's what I believe. I believe that, again, as I was saying, movie can make a difference. And mainly when we cannot, you know, fight in a different way, bring that on the emotional level is what we need. So that's why, that's what I try to do with the movie.
Philippe Diaz, you've been working with human rights advocates to bring healing for current and past detainees. Please tell us about the Art from Guantanamo Bay campaign.
Yes, I'm happy to tell you that because, in fact, the reality is that people should realize that, you know, so there was roughly, we never know the exact number because the government makes sure to keep that secret, and I'll tell you why. It's always, when you ask the government how many people were transferred to Guantanamo, it's around 780 people, around. Now we have pretty much like another 30 people left there. So there was like 750, maybe something like that, around. Very often, not all the time, but very often in a country which is not theirs, in a country where they don't even speak the language, they are released with no money. They are released sometimes without their identity, their ID cards, because it had been taken away from them. So a lot of organizations started to help them raise funds. We partnered even with one of them to try to raise funds for them. And when we had our premiere, this wonderful art when they were in Guantanamo, after, let's say, the very bad years when they were really tortured on a regular basis, and it started to relax a little bit, and it was clear that most of these men were innocent. Because we should always remember that out of all these 800 men around which were sent to Guantanamo, only 5 were charged with any kind of link with terrorism. You know, and sometimes it's to be the driver of one of the terrorists, or sometimes it's to be a messenger bringing messages from one to the other. So very low-end people, but the others were never charged with anything. So when it relaxed a little bit, they started to be allowed to have a little bit more freedom, to be not in solitary confinement, but with other detainees. And they were allowed to do some kind of writing or painting. That's why we decided to do this exhibit in LA. There was this great organization who was doing it. And if people go on the website, iamgitmo.com, you know, they will find all this information. But we still have, so we sold some of this painting. We are still continuing to sell them because we hope to help them to, in any way we can. You cannot ruin the life of someone because, you know, what do you think the person can go back to his normal life and take care of his family again? No, they can't. So we ruin the lives of 800 people without counting the one who died, because even the CIA acknowledged that, and I quote, yes, we lost a few. So, you know, so we cannot ruin the life of all these people and have them go by themselves without any compensation, without any reparation, without nothing. So that's the whole thing.
Philippe, you've made an extraordinary film. Tell us where listeners can see it and how listeners can learn more about Cinema Libre's other films and your new streaming service.
Yes, absolutely. Well, the Cinema Libre Studio, again, was created 33 years ago to be able to do this kind of film in total freedom. And it's why we decided, of course, to become our own distributor, put movies in theaters, on home video, on streaming, et cetera, because if you don't have distribution, you have nothing. The reality is when someone watch one of our movies on Amazon Prime, we receive 5 cents from Amazon Prime or something like that. When someone watch one of our film on Tubi, we are supposed to share the receipt of the advertising. I think we received 7 cents. So, of course, that doesn't work for us, but that doesn't work for the filmmaker who sometimes spent years making his movie and sometimes mortgage his house or whatever it is. So that's why we embark on saying, okay, that doesn't work anymore. Let's create our own streaming platform who will be also focused on human rights, social issue, et cetera, et cetera. We had several instances in the past where Amazon and all the other platforms decided to censor simply one of our movies because they didn't feel it was politically correct. Let's say it like that. You know, so we created this streaming platform called clsnow.tv. CLS because it stands from Cinema Libre Studio, so CLS, and now because you can watch movie now.tv. And so that we hope so, and it's the same than any other platform. People can subscribe for a very low fee, like $6.50 a month. They can see every movie they want for $3.25, or they can watch every movie for free with advertising.
Well, Philippe Diaz, thank you so much for speaking with us today on Law and Disorder. And just to let listeners know, we will have all of those links on our website, lawanddisorder.org, as well.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much for keeping the issue of Guantanamo alive. I think that's the most important.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The notorious detention center at Guantanamo Bay is high among the most shameful steps the U.S. took during George W. Bush's war on terror. It is still open and remains a symbol of lawlessness and human rights abuses. In a recent letter earlier this year, 17 U.S. senators sent to President Biden, urging him to act swiftly to close Guantanamo, arguing that the detention facility continues to harm U.S. national security by serving as a propaganda tool for America's enemies and is hindering U.S. counterterrorism efforts and cooperation with allies. January 11, 2024, marked the 22nd anniversary of Guantanamo's opening. It has cost the United States $540 million each year. That's almost a total of $12 billion and counting. There are now still 30 men remaining in detention at Guantanamo, more than half of whom have not been charged with any crime and have been approved by the U.S. national security leadership for transfer out of Guantanamo. Some of these men have been approved for transfer for years, and at least one has been approved for transfer for more than a decade. Yet these 16 men have continued to languish in indefinite detention. None of the innocent detainees has ever been compensated for their wrongful detention. Sadly, Guantanamo is but one example of the forms of torture which the United States engages in and supports. Right now, over 120,000 people are being held in U.S. prisons and jails in solitary confinement. To discuss the issue of torture and the ongoing human rights disaster at Guantanamo and in solitary confinement in U.S. prisons, we are joined today by Reverend Ron Stief, an ordained minister in the United Church of Christ, who is the executive director of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture, NARCAT, an interfaith organization of more than 325 religious organizations committed to ending U.S.-sponsored torture. Reverend Stief sits and is past chair of the steering committee of Shoulder to Shoulder, Standing with American Muslims, Upholding American Values. He co-leads the national advocacy strategy of the Washington, D.C. interreligious staff community, and is a member of the Federal Anti-Solitary Task Force, which works to end solitary confinement in federal prisons, jails, and immigrant detention. Ron, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Ron, it's been a pleasure working with you over the years. Please explain the mission of NARCAT and why you've made closing Guantanamo such a top priority.
Well, yes, and we can start the story of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture by remembering that President George W. Bush opened the detention camp at U.S. Naval Station Guantanamo Bay on Cuba on January 11, 2002, during the so-called Global War on Terror. This was designed to hold and interrogate alleged terrorism suspects. Guantanamo was chosen. Notice they didn't bring the suspects here to the U.S. They were really chosen in the hope that the detainees there would be beyond the reach of U.S. courts. So from the very get-go, in fact, one of the Bush administration officials put it this way, Guantanamo was to be the legal equivalent of outer space, meaning none of the judicial mechanisms that we have to deal with people would be applied there, and it was instead handed over to a military commission. It's important to know that Guantanamo has held 779 detainees since that date in 2002, all of them Muslim, which is also key to remember, and all but a handful without charge or trial. Nine detainees have died there, and 30 are still there today. So the story of the National Religious Campaign Against Torture was when word that this was the CIA torture program and Guantanamo were being initiated, the faith community came together, really had a large meeting, all of us. And we said, look, there's a lot of things that we don't agree on, but the one thing we do agree on is that torture is wrong, torture is immoral. Torture violates every tenet of any conception of the right relation to God or Allah or Yahweh or the divine among all the different faith traditions, that one human being cannot torture another human being for any reason under divine law. So in D.C., while the debate was raging on over does torture work, does it not, does it gain reliable information, which we know that it doesn't, was the CIA torture legal? We know it wasn't. But for the faith community, we stood in the gap, you might say, to say, none of this matters. You just don't torture people, period. End of story. And this was all while the torture was still going on. So we called for the Bush administration to shut down the torture program and facilities at Guantanamo, to close the secret CIA prisons, which early on were just rumored to exist. Now we know they existed all over the world. And we initiated campaigns for accountability for anyone who participated in the torture program in any way. So our national coalition, all through this time, over the last 22 years, we have been responding with vigils to close Guantanamo, letter to the editors campaign, advocacy meetings with sympathetic members of Congress who have played a significant role in pointing out that we need to close Guantanamo as well. We put pressure on the Bush administration that carries through today with the pressure we put on the Biden administration from day one, even before Biden came into office, to finish the job and close Guantanamo and close this ugly chapter of American history, which is marked by torture and massive human rights abuses.
Ron, as a follow-up to that, how did these men end up in Guantanamo? There are stories now because some have been released and told of their harrowing circumstances. Explain from a human standpoint how these individuals were seized by the U.S. government and taken there.
Well, there have actually been a couple of books that have been written by former Guantanamo detainees, and you can hear about who was there. They can talk to some extent about who their other detainees were that they were with. There are also several movies that have kind of shown people were just picked up off the street, basically. Now, note that there were 779 people that went through, and we're down to 30 who just a few even need a trial. There's 16 of those that were cleared for release. All of them got cleared for release because they had nothing to do with the war on terror. Many were, to put it one way, brokered in by human traffickers and picked up and detained and taken away. Taxi drivers, people who just happened to be living across the street from somebody who said, no, it wasn't me, it was that person right there. those are the kind of people that have been in Guantanamo, that endured the torture. I mean, again, not that anybody deserves torture, but especially someone who was just picked up off the street and sold into detention by human traffickers and just picked up because of bad information that we had. That's who was and still is in Guantanamo.
The United States government paid money to warlords in exchange for some of these prisoners?
Well, yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Look, Guantanamo and the whole torture program that the CIA launched was basically to show the world how tough we were. And to do that, you had to also convince the locals that you would stop at nothing to crack down on terror. And so it was. These were distorted examples. Maybe in a few cases, they actually thought the people actually had done something. This was just gathering bodies to show the world that we'll come after you and we'll hunt you down, which is a phrase that actually both President Bush and I think President Obama one time used to dehumanize people and therefore just say, we're going to round you up. Anybody that had, we think, even if we think you just had something to do, you're going to get rounded up if you participate or even think about joining this war on terror that we're trying to stop at this point, you know, after 2002.
Well, earlier this year, the National Religious Campaign Against Torture joined with a wide variety of other organizations, including the ACLU, American Friends Service Committee, American Muslim Bar Association, Amnesty International, Center for Constitutional Rights, Center for Victims of Torture, Code Pink, Council on American-Islamic Relations and Human Rights Watch, as well as Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace, No More Guantanamos, Reprieve, the Shoulder to Shoulder Campaign, and the Episcopal Church, calling on President Biden to close Guantanamo. Reverend Ron Stief, what has the Biden administration done about closing Guantanamo? What more should they be doing?
Well, this is a very salient question coming as it is in the last year of the Biden administration. Both President Biden and before him, President Obama, made pledges to close Guantanamo. And yet, despite public opinion polls that as the years go on, increasingly support any action that the Biden administration would make to close Guantanamo, very little has been done. Now, I want to break that down a little bit. We can look back to the work of the Senate Intelligence Committee in 2013, where, you know, President Obama and Biden both have an incredibly powerful tool in the torture report that was issued by the Senate Intelligence Committee. They were not able to release the whole torture report, but an executive summary, and there is a lot of evidence in there with interviews and looking at public documents, much of which detailed the torture that occurred at Guantanamo. So out of that executive summary, we were able to even get Congress to do something, which I know people don't think is very easy to get Congress to do something. It isn't. But we were able to get Congress in 2015 to put an amendment in the National Defense Authorization Act that banned the CIA from ever launching a torture program or engaging in the torture of detainees like they did post 9/11. So the U.S. Senate took steps to ban CIA torture, both on moral and national security grounds. Well, there's momentum here. I mean, if you're in Washington, there is momentum. You're on the right side of history if you, as president, act to close Guantanamo. Now, here's what President Biden faces. Of the 30 who still are in Guantanamo, 16 have been pre-cleared for transfer, and the State Department needs to find a country that will take them. They haven't done that yet. Most of these transfers could have been done right away by the administration. Year after year, the advocacy communities and U.S. senators, led by Senator Dick Durbin, who has been great, who chairs the Senate Judiciary Committee, send memos to the administration, request and have meetings. Now is the time to take a political stand. There's no other way out. I think it's important for people to know that it is a political decision. Guantanamo is in a situation where there is no end in sight because the thorny legal issues that we're facing in Guantanamo is that no one, by act of Congress, no one can actually be brought to the United States to be tried in a court of law, and they're subject to the military commissions. The military commissions are broken. They haven't worked, they don't work, and those involved in the, even the military commission chief prosecutor has been supporting the Biden administration to use its own authority to resolve the cases. If nothing else, just so family members of those who died in the attacks of 9/11 can gain some resolution on this just small handful of cases that need to be resolved. Now, there is, I think, one of the main things the Biden administration can do, and it's in the legal realm now, is to reach plea agreements with the detainees who still haven't had their day in court. Like I said, there's really no way to do that in the military commission system right now. And so at the legal front, the Biden administration could clear these remaining detainees with a plea agreement, resulting in jail time if they're found guilty. And the vitriol in Washington is horrible right now. I think everybody knows that. When President Biden just kind of floated that idea, Mitch McConnell publicly attacked him in one of the most vicious statements I've ever really seen anyone make against a president in Congress. So those of us who are out in the communities need to be advocating, putting pressure, continuing to call the president to make the political choice to get this job done in the final year of this administration, regardless of any political fire it will be drawn. I mean, torture is a moral issue. You need to make your stand on moral issues and let history and maybe even the upcoming election be the judge, but you've got to take the moral stand if you want to be a responsible leader, and that's where President Biden is right now, and we're just continuing to hope that we can get some kind of action out of the administration to move Guantanamo even closer to closure, if not close it itself before he leaves office.
Well, Guantanamo itself is a form of solitary confinement. So let's turn to that issue. NARCAT has called solitary confinement in American prisons an egregious form of torture. Describe for us how widespread solitary confinement is in America and what efforts NARCAT and its allies are taking to end this inhumane punishment.
Well, yeah, so many of the same faith community members that we have, like we said, we have 320 organizational members around the country. Many of them were, when we first started this campaign, focused. Security issues around detention and torture, the kind of torture you see in the movies where people are waterboarded and the kind of torture that actually happened in Guantanamo where people are thrown against walls, being threatened for information. That was the same kind of thing was happening here in the United States inside our solitary confinement cells right in our own backyards. So, doing on Guantanamo. Many of them knew about the detentions in Guantanamo, and they said, what about us? What about the 120,000 people in the United States who are right now sitting inside cells the size of a parking space? Tiny, often windowless cells. They're sitting in there well beyond the 15 days of isolation that the United Nations and most of the world deems as torture. Aren't we torturing people right here? In our own country, we once again, the faith community pulled together and we launched our campaign to work on behalf of the 120,000 people that are sitting in solitary confinement cells in the U.S. right now. And I'm very proud of the progress that the community advocates have made thus far. I mean, it's still an incredibly intractable problem, and it's so hard to try to get prisons and jails to change anything that they're doing because most of it is kind of a business as usual, do today what we did yesterday and everybody will be happy operation. But that's not what it is. It's a place where people are being tortured when they end up in solitary confinement. So right now there are 23 state campaigns led by ACLU, Unlock the Box, Center for Constitutional Rights, Many of the organizations that have supported NearCAD over the years, all of our faith organizations, these 23 state campaigns are to end solitary confinement in state prisons. There are several city campaigns. New York, Connecticut, New Jersey, and just this year, Nevada, have all passed laws, been signed by their governors, to end all solitary confinement in state prisons and jails. I should say all prolonged solitary, because there are times when people need to be separated. But in those states, if they implement the laws, and we're working to get them to do that, no one will be sitting inside a solitary confinement cell inside their prisons or jails for more than a few hours or a few days, but certainly not for weeks, months, years, and even decades, which is what's happening now. So we work at the state level and city level because this is where 90% of all the people in solitary confinement are held. So, you know, think about the momentum and progress we're making on this major issue of torture and human rights, ending solitary in our own states, our own backyards. Google it and see, or use whatever search engine you want. See if you have a state campaign. See if you have a local city campaign. See if you have a local city council member or a local state legislator who's a champion on this issue in your state.
Reverend Ron Stief, I understand the End Solitary Confinement Act was introduced in the U.S. Congress last year. What would that bill do? Where does it stand? And what can listeners do to support it?
So the act ends all solitary confinement in all federal prisons, jails, and other detention settings, including immigration detention, which is a federal operation. Does provide limited exceptions, you know, gives provisions for emergency de-escalation inside the facility, gives provisions for separation and evaluation by mental health counselors. Really what the End Solitary Confinement Act does is asks Congress to codify the known solutions that we have. And now that we've been at this for quite a while, to try to find alternatives, therapeutic alternatives to solitary confinement, we have a pretty good sense of how prisons can actually institute policies and procedures that will ensure that they don't just write somebody up and throw them in a solitary confinement cell and just leave them sit there for a while. And, you know, we don't want that to happen to people, obviously. So the End Solitary Confinement Act really does try to take it to the federal level and say, okay, the 10% of people in overall who are in solitary are in federal facilities. We need to get them out of that prolonged solitary confinement. I think for those who are concerned about what happens with immigrants when they're detained in this country, many of whom are here seeking asylum from conditions of torture, which is what makes this so maddening. A recent report by Physicians for Social Responsibility and some researchers at Harvard talked about between 2018 and 2023, there were more than 14,000 placements in solitary confinement by ICE, which is Immigration Customs Enforcement. 14,000 placements in solitary over those 5 years. And here's where the incarcerated immigrants who've already gone through such incredible trauma are placed when they have pre-existing mental health conditions as reprisal for reporting everything from sexual abuse to lack of religious resources to poor and unsanitary conditions, complaining about forced labor, land in solitary confinement. It's the same reason that people go to solitary confinement in all the other U.S. prisons. They didn't kill anybody. They didn't hurt anybody. So here again, extending from the prisons and jails to the immigration detention program, solitary confinement is used to control and instill fear in prison populations, not to serve any rehab purposes or to make facilities safer. Pretty much everybody knows that. And that is the big lie that we're trying to push back with on our advocacy, not only through the Federal Anti-Solitary Confinement Act, but the state and local legislative and legal actions that we're taking right now to try to get people out of solitary.
Every June, human rights and faith organizations join together to mark Torture Awareness Month. What initiatives is NARCAT taking this month, probably every month to end torture in the United States.
Well, you're right. It is every month. For us, every month is Torture Awareness Month. But there's some real special significance to June, because this is a global issue as well. I mean, we're talking about the United States, but it's a global issue. But on June 26th of 1987, the nations of the world took a major step, standing against the immoral and abhorrent practice of torture, the UN Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment went into effect. So it was adopted by unanimous agreement of the UN General Assembly, all saying, yes, we should not be torturing people. It's immoral. Signed by the United States on April 18th, 1988. If, for example, to just look at what is happening with NearCAT's work this Torture Awareness Month, we're asking people to show our relatively new 35-minute film on torture in our name. It documents three of our state campaigns that work to actually end torture in their states, New Jersey, New York, and Louisiana. As I mentioned, Connecticut has comprehensive ban as well. Louisiana has a ban on special populations. This is the activists themselves, the solitary survivors themselves, the legal beagles, the faith community, all working, vigiling, praying, advocating to end the solitary confinement in their state. You know, here's where this ties into Guantanamo on Torture Awareness Month. We all want the United States to have a strong presence in advocating for human rights around the world. And yet, every time the U.S. tries to intervene on global issues of global torture, I know for a fact just recently from Russia and from China, when being criticized by their human rights violations of their own populations or immigrant populations, they just pointed to Guantanamo and they said, well, what about that? Why are you telling us what to do on human rights? Why don't you clean up your own backyard? So we can see how the fact that Guantanamo is still open impacts the way in which the world sees the United States as, you know, are they really serious about standing up against torture? We've signed the UN document. We say we do, but we have to prove it with our actions. So Torture Awareness Month is a time for people to vigil, to, again, connect with their members of Congress and really push to see if we can get Guantanamo closed and get our governors to start to take some action and our state legislatures to take some action to close it in our own backyard.
Ron, you and I have worked on these issues for years. I'm so grateful for what you do every day. I know that people can go to www.narcat.org. And thank you so much for being on Law and Disorder.
You're welcome, Steve. Thank you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk more about the attacks on pro-Palestinian protesters with the president of the Muslim Public Affairs Council.
Co-founder and president Salam al-Mariati joins us to talk about his efforts to hold university officials and law enforcement accountable for allowing attacks against pro-Palestinian protesters.
We'll also speak with graduate student Javier Fitzsimmons Cruz, who was arrested after the encampment was torn down.
He vividly describes the situation at the NYU encampment, and after all, he ran from his arrest to defend his dissertation.
Stay with us.
I'm Stephen Rohde, retired civil rights lawyer and author on issues of civil liberties.
And I'm Maria Hall, Los Angeles civil rights lawyer.
As the Israeli-Gaza war rages on, protests have spread throughout American campuses as students oppose Israeli military onslaught and the tragic humanitarian crisis in Gaza. Students have demanded a ceasefire, an end to U.S. military support for Israel, and that universities divest from Israel. In response, university officials have suspended and expelled students, banned pro-Palestinian student groups, called in the police and sent mixed messages on students' right to free speech. At UCLA, a group of counter-protesters launched a violent attack on pro-Palestinian protesters. To address these critical issues, we've invited Salam Al-Mariati, president and co-founder of the Muslim Public Affairs Council, where he oversees MPAC's groundbreaking civic engagement, public policy, and advocacy work. Salam Al-Mariati is an expert on Islam in the West, Muslim reform movements, human rights.
WRCT Pittsburgh.
You will never find the more wretched hive of scum and villainy. We must be cautious.
Thank you.